good afternoon and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 32 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Amon Warman.
I'm Hannah Flint.
And I'm Clarice Lockery.
Steven Soderbergh is back to his heisting A-list casting ways in No Sudden Move. You can't choose family, but you can throw them down a hole. It's John and the Hole. Is this haunted podcast actually stretching, or is it your imagination? Or is it just a Muppets Haunted Mansion special?
It's from the ride. It's from the ride. Because you go and you go in the room and it looks like it's stretching, but it's not actually stretching. It's an elevator.
This is your one warning that you might want to block out 20 to 25 minutes for just Clarice talking about the Haunted Mansion ride and everything to do with that when we come to discussing that particular film. Because I suspect Clarice has a few things to say.
My favorite thing.
Plus, for this week's hot take, we ask, is anyone still looking forward to Fantastic Beasts? Does anyone still want this movie?
Anybody? Bueller?
But before all of that, let's check in with the crew. Hannah, Clarice, you've been podcasting away from the Fade to Black podcast, and it's now up. I believe.
It's live. Is that right? Yeah, sorry. Yay. This is the end of the Fade to Black podcast, final episode. We're taking over Picture House. Apologies, but find us there.
Yeah, Amon, sorry. You got to go down in the hole, the John in the hole.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, I was trying to like link it into the movie, and I realized it's very dark, and I'm sorry.
It was very dark. Sorry. I would starve very quickly. But yeah, I'm
looking
forward.
Oh, we'd throw you down food. We'd be better than... We'd throw you down snacks all the time. Okay. Constant
I want
snacks.
I want some jello rice. I want some plantain. You know, some Chinese takeaway. PlayStation 5.
I want to be in this hole. 50-inch
white
smooth. I'll come in with you.
It's the world's greatest hole.
Really, though. Hook it up. But yes, excited to listen back to that. What else have you guys been up to this week?
I think we've all been dealing with lack of sleep, to be honest, because London Film Festival has begun.
It has.
And so we've seen quite a few movies already, but obviously we'll hold the reviews for when they come out and release. But we caught The Hard They Fall. What else have you caught this week? Spencer, we've been doing. Also, we've got some good interviews lined up as well to come. I'm going to be speaking to Ruth Negger on Monday about Passing. Clarice, you're speaking to a special lady.
Yes, I just a couple of hours ago spoke to the wonderful Léa Seydoux about French Dispatch. And she's so nice. I just like her a lot. And I did that very awkward thing where I talked about the fact that I can't really speak French. And she said, French is a very hard language. I was like, oui. C'est très difficile. Awesome. Et moi, je suis stupide.
I'm excited to listen to it already. But yeah, London Film Festival has indeed kicked off. It's a time of the year which I always enjoy. It's all of the films, all of the time, for a good 11 days. If you are a film fan, do try and get yourself down. There's a number of films which are playing, which I'm excited to see. King Richard is one, which I can't say anything yet, but King Richard is one you should keep an eye out for.
King Richard is a movie that is playing at Bella
Fest. Phantom of the Open is another film you should keep an eye out for. Titan is the most bonkers film you will see this year.
Can I just make a pledge on this podcast so we all say Titan.
I'm all about the Titan.
So yeah, check out the program. It's on BFI's website right now. So yeah, check it out and get yourself down there. But let's get on with the show because we have a few films and we're going to start with No Sudden Move.
What do you want?
Is that something you'd say? Normal Monday?
I'm gonna shoot you right now.
Can I go home now?
Wait at the house after.
What do you mean after?
Right off of your
feet. What is going on?
What's going on, big guy?
Yeah, what are we doing?
We're following instructions. Are you helping me or are you not helping me?
No.
This is a stick-up, boys! Give us your hot takes on No Sudden Move and nobody gets hurt! Yes, we're talking about Steven Soderbergh's latest No Sudden Move. This is set in 1954 Detroit, where small-time criminals are hired to steal a document. When their heist goes horribly wrong, their search for who hired them and for what purpose sends them winding through all echelons of the race-torn, rapidly changing city. This is directed by Steven Soderbergh, is starring Don Cheadle, Benicio Del Toro, David Harbour, John Hamm, Amy Smith, Brendan Fraser, and Kieran Culkin of Succession fame. Succession, a show which I've just started watching. We will discuss, I'm sure, once I'm done. But that is an incredible ensemble. Hannah, what did you make of just the acting here and all of these amazing people in this movie?
I think it's a great crew of people. They got lots of lots of names.
Going deep, Hannah, deep.
I can sense a bot coming.
I mean, Donald Cheadle made some choices. Don Cheadle made some choices that I don't think the rest of the crew were like on board with. Like, he was going a certain way that felt kind of like, this is the character I'm going to go for. Like, this is going to be like with the accent and stuff. Whereas I just don't think anyone else was like in on that. So it felt a little bit kind of, it felt a bit caricaturist compared to like everyone else that seemed pretty, like, if, how do I describe it? It felt like there was a contemporary sensibility in the kind of how this was playing out, and what he was doing was like, I'm going to be this quite period drama, pretend I'm actually this like old Hollywood kind of gangster type. So I don't know if that kind of meshed well for me. And yeah, I think Noah Jupe, I always think Noah Jupe is a very reliable child star. I'm very interested to see when he makes that transition, because obviously Kira Kolke was a child star. As was his brother Macaulay, famously. And it took a while, I think, for Kieran to escape that sort of like image, and then obviously come back in the most like ridiculous way in Succession, and now we can't see him as anything other than Roman. And it's interesting that this kind of character he plays seems more in common with that kind of guy, that kind of acting. So I'm talking a lot about other things that isn't about the movie. But it did kind of remind me of why I like these actors. I don't know if I felt there was too many, in a way, too many people, so you didn't really get a real deeper performance. It seemed like there was a lot of plate spinning.
Yeah, I think that's my sort of like main takeaway, is that this is quite like light Steven Soderbergh. The way that I framed it in my mind while watching it was like, look, he made this over the pandemic, and I feel like during the pandemic a lot of us have been returning to old comforts and old habits, and I think it must have been quite like reassuring and nice for Steven Soderbergh to reunite with like a lot of actors that he's worked before, but also the idea of this like sprawling A-list cast, because he's the kind of guy who can just phone anybody up in Hollywood and say, do you want to be in my movie? And they go, yes, please. And also, you know, the sort of heist framework and the crime and the way that like a lot of the appeal of this movie is how clever it is and how all the things are overlapping, and you go, oh, this person is connected to this person. I see. Ooh, interesting. I think, Hannah, what you said is bang on. It's like, it's a very busy movie, and it's nice, but like, I don't know. It's nice. I'm not going to write home about it.
I think I'm a little bit more up on this one than you guys. Like, I really dug the cast. I didn't even mention when I ran down the cast there, the fact that this movie has Bill Duke in it. And when he showed up, it was like, this guy is still the coolest brother alive. So I just love the fact that he's in this. I really enjoyed what David Harbour was doing. I think he's really good at playing weasels and guys who are just weaklings. And he sort of brings out those facets of the character in a really effective way as the film goes on. And Don Cheadle, you know, this just made me, it reminded me of Devil in the Blue Dress and his performance in that. And, you know, unfortunately we never got a sequel to that. This is almost like, you can imagine that this is the character he plays in that just a few years later down the line. So I appreciated that as well. So I really liked the ensemble of this. Benicio Del Toro and the back and forth chemistry that he has with Don Cheadle in this movie, that also worked for me too. Khaleesi, you mentioned a little bit in terms of the plot, which, you know, but true to Soderbergh form, is very twisty turny. What I liked about that is that, again, Soderbergh always does this, all the twists and turns happen to the characters in real time, so we have to figure it out as they figure it out. And I enjoyed that. Hannah, what did you make of the plot and the twisty turny nature of everything that happened in this movie?
Again, it just felt just a bit basic. and you know, the kind of like, we need a document. Oh no, we've been double crossed. Oh, and it just kind of like this, it could have been shorter. It could have got to the point quicker. And actually, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, I think the kind of what we find out about what this document is, you know, that's a quite interesting, quite modern like idea, especially it's like when you think about, oh shit, it's like, this is actually an environmental movie. It's all about saving the planet. But like, yeah, I just, it didn't keep me, I wasn't engaged. I didn't feel engaged about it.
The one thing I didn't really vibe with was that some of the visuals that Soderbergh was trying for in certain scenes weren't really working for me. Although the score by David Holmes is great.
Very jazzy. I like that.
Yeah.
I found it uninteresting to look at. I mean, he didn't shoot on an iPhone as he had done with his previous two movies, Unsane and High Flying Birds, but it did have that kind of muted quality that didn't feel that rich or vibrant to look at. It just was very, it's like subdued. And
yeah, the like fisheye, the use of the fisheye lens is very interesting. I commend his like commitment to it, because he's doing something. And for some of his other films, it's looked great. I just think, yeah, I think for this, it just seemed a little bit odd, because it's like, you know, doing a certain technical flair, like, without reasoning about, like, because it's like, well, why are we having the fisheye lens for this? It's just me. There were a couple of moments while I was watching it going, oh, is there something wrong with my laptop? Oh, like, is it been compressed weirdly? And then I remembered, oh yeah, this is a Steven Soderbergh movie. It's probably on purpose. Because it's the goddamn fisheye lens. So yeah, I found that just strange, not really positive or negative, just, I feel like that's how I feel about this movie. It's just like, you know, it's like when you make yourself a ham sandwich and you're like, pretty great.
this was like egg mayo. I would say.
This feels like barbecue chicken to me, but clearly not to you guys, which is fine. But the time has come for our stream and skip recommendations. I say stream and skip and not screen, because this is going to be coming to digital download and Sky Cinema, and now from the 10th of October. So no cinema release for this Soderbergh film, which is a bit of a shame. But regardless, stream or skip, Hannah?
I mean, I'm going to say skip. Although it is one of the better, I would say, considering some of the films that have gone to Sky, I think it's the better one. But, and also if you're, I don't know, Steven Soderbergh, it just didn't work for me. And I feel like I don't want to like dismiss Steven Soderbergh. But I think maybe if you enjoy his work and you want to kind of keep up with it and have a look, go for it. But it wasn't something I'd be interested in watching this weekend.
Cool. I'm gonna say stream. I enjoyed it, and I really liked seeing Brendan Fraser. I'm happy he's making a big movie. I mean, he's been making movies this whole time. I'm glad he's like working with all these like cool directors again. Happy to see you, Brendan.
May the Brendan nascence continue. Indeed. And yeah, it's a stream from me. I really dug this one. And Bill Duke, again, coolest brother alive. But we're going from no sudden move, we're moving into a hole. We're talking about John and the Hole.
Last month, John asked me something. It's a weird question. He wanted to know what it's like to be an adult.
Can you please stop?
When do you stop being a kid? I didn't know what to tell him. I don't think he liked that.
And the whole Holy shit, that kid needs some therapy. Yes, this is a psychological thriller from the writer who contributed to the screenplay, Birdman. Remember the Michael Keaton Oscar nominated? The writer here is Nicolas Jacobon, who here adapts his own short story, El Pozo. The film stars Charlie Shotwell, Michael C. Hall, Jennifer L., and Thaisa Farmiga, sister of Vera Farmiga. And this is about a desperate game of survival, which unfolds in a quite rich American home, where 13-year-old John traps his family in a hole. Yes, you heard that right. A hole in the ground, in the woodlands, outside the family home.
No PS5 or TV. Terrible.
It's not a great hole at all. Not anything to do with the hole. Do you remember that Keira Knightley movie from West Bend?
Yes. What a movie.
It's not as big as that hole. It's actually a very small hole.
This is sorry.
I'm just gonna keep saying hole.
The impulse to say that's what she said. I'm sorry.
Name of your sex tape. Okay. Anyway.
Be quiet.
Let's be serious. Let's take this film about a hole that a kid puts his family in seriously. So, directed by Pasquale Sisto, this is quite a minimalist movie, despite quite a lot of dread. So, Clarice, I'd love you to talk to me a bit about tonally how you think this film works.
Well, I think this kind of reminded me in a very weird way of Pig. Because you know when we're talking about Pig, how it really leads you into thinking it's one movie. It's going to be the Nicolas Cage exploitation and he's got my pig back. And I feel like this is kind of the same thing. It's speaking in that sort of cinematic shorthand for this is going to kind of be like a Michael Haneke movie. Because you open on it and the house they live in is like so bourgeois, like Scandi minimalism, big glass windows, they all look very fashionable, and the camera is so still, you know, it's sort of quite, I guess it's always like watching them through windows and things, so you get this feeling of like, oh, this kid is about to do some violence. but that's not really what the film is. And that's what I like about it. It keeps tricking you into thinking that something much worse is going to happen than what actually happens. And in reality, I've kind of, in my brain, John in the hole is like opposite Peter Pan. Because you know how like Peter Pan ran away from his family to go to Neverland so he could be a kid forever. This one, he's like, okay, I'm going to remove my family from my house, put them in a hole, so that I can be an adult, and so the house becomes his Neverland. But it's like a weird Neverland. There's no mermaids here, guys. I don't know. Does that make sense? That's how it works in my brain.
Yeah, and I suppose it's asking you to do, to read between the lines, because there's not really that much dialogue. How much do you think I'm on that kind of work, that, you know, it's not that clear, the motivation. So how do you think that affected the pacing of this film, as, you know, the longer they're in that hole, you're wondering where this is going to go.
Yeah. All of the things you said had a sort of negative impact on my, you know, viewing of this film. I found the tone, the pacing glacial. Found it monotonous in many respects, and I get what they're going for in terms of this is a story about a kid sort of, you know, trying to be an adult, but it's such a broad theme that they don't really give as much specificness as I would like from a movie like this. And the framing device as well, the way in which they tell that side of the story really didn't work for me. We only get the title card to the 30 minutes into the movie, which is when it feels like everything kicks off, and the 30 minutes that precede that feel like, you know, very forgettable, sort of, you know, almost removed from the movie type thing that you don't really need to see, at least for me. I had a hard time with this one. Even just the logistics of this kid, very lanky kid, sort of managing to put his entire family into this deep hole somehow, unscathed. Like, it's like, how did he manage? I mean, I guess I could sort of let that go because I know this is sort of, you know, divorced from reality to a certain extent. But yeah, I didn't really enjoy this one.
Yeah, I didn't really vibe. I could have done without the framing device. I don't think that. I think it would have been far more mysterious and kind of like nervy and I suppose lean into the fact, this idea where it's not actually giving, spoon feeding you an explanation. Because I think it's basically this is not a film that's basically saying, this is why this person's done it and this is why these things happen. It's actually just like, this is a scenario and we're going to let it play out. And, you know, you're going to either go with it or you're not. So, but I felt like the framing device seemed more like an afterthought where they thought people weren't going to ask too many questions. But if anything, that just added more questions to me about it. What did you think about the performances, though? And also, I think, I mean, Charlie Shotwell, who plays John, he's a very, I mean, the cat, what's interesting is like this sociopathic kind of character. How well do you think he delivered that? I suppose just, for me, he kept me guessing. Like, I kind of was like waiting for the other shoe to drop all the way through.
He is good at keeping you guessing. There's a couple of moments where I really didn't know if he was going to sort of cross another line or whether he would, you know, stay. There were a couple of moments where I didn't know whether he was going to cross a line. And that sort of speaks to the unpredictable nature of his performance. But this is one of those films where nobody really talks like a proper human. And that sort of disaffected nature translates to me watching it, because if I sort of can't resonate with that, then it just makes everything a more difficult watch. And Shotwell is sort of, you know, the guy who was spending the most time with in this movie, he's very sort of, you know, has sort of that stilted dialogue way of speaking, which again is not natural. And I get that that's purposeful to a certain extent, but it means that for me watching it, it just made things more difficult to connect with me.
What I really like, I guess I really like the contrast between, like, Charlie Shotwell doing this, like, fully deadpan. am I gonna murder you or not? Contrasting with, I think, what Michael C. Hall, Jennifer L., and Thaisa Farmiga are doing, which, like, to me, they're all actors who have, I guess, a little bit of horror experience or varying levels of horror experience. And they were giving me horror performances. There's a lot of screaming and crying, begging for mercy. I just like the contrast between a completely emotionless performance and like these more sort of exaggerated, in danger performances. But I agree with the thing. I think, like, I've been very positive about it so far, but I agree with the framework doesn't really work. And I think the ending as well, as much as I like that they undercut things all the time, it feels like the ending should have gone somewhere else than where it goes. So in the vaguest terms possible.
Yeah, I think I wanted a little bit more of a conclusion, whether it was, you know, positive or negative. I just wanted something, you know, just something that felt like we've, you know, it was this, I suppose it's this kind of, you know, this anticipation. We've been waiting and waiting for some sort of climactic, some cathartic release. And it didn't give us that. And I suppose, you know, maybe that's, you know, that's the purpose as well. Like, it's just about the journey. It's not about A and B. It's about just getting there. And I suppose I think in a way, as much as I did think, I agree in a sense what you're saying, Aman, about the kind of, it sometimes felt a bit tedious. But there are moments where it really felt disturbing. A pool scene. or the thing where he's dealing with a friend. And what I think was interesting about Charlie Shotwell as an actor, him being 13, but he's also quite tall. So he is, what was really, you get in this whole film about kind of wanting to grow up. That also played into it quite well. But yeah, I would say I found this far more engaging as a subject for me than No Sudden Move, because I quite like that it has that kind of funny game, psychological, you know, as you said, it kind of felt like a Scandi sort of drama situation where, yeah, it's not spoon feeding me stuff. It's actually, you're allowed to, I suppose, imprint your own ideas on it in a way.
I get that. And I don't sort of, you know, want everything to be spoon-fed for me. I just think that it could have done more to explain a couple of things so that it could meet me halfway. I think we're doing a lot of interpretive heavy lifting with this movie.
So, Clarice, did it meet you halfway enough to earn a stream or a screen rating?
Yeah, I think stream. If you're into the sort of like, kind of, I guess, Michael Haneke, Yorgos Lanthimos vibe.
It's a skip from me. Did not vibe with this one. Sorry.
I'm going to say stream. I liked it better than No Sudden Move. And yeah, I like to be disturbed. I feel like it's spooky season. Let's get disturbed. And speaking of spooky season.
Welcome to the home of fear and fright, where not all guests survive the night. The lucky souls will live to tell, and those who don't will rot in.
What's the matter with you? You can't say that. This is a family show.
What are you doing?
Welcome, foolish puppets,
to tonight's very special Halloween challenge.
We just have to survive the night in this haunted mansion.
Everything here will seem familiar. But your eyes may deceive you.
Ooh, whoa. I'm the mysterious Nanda Pagunta.
Wait, stop.
Turn it down, I can't hear myself think.
Okay, so I don't actually know how to introduce this because there are 3 million references that I could make. And it's too much. I'm too excited. Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Muppets Haunted Mansion, where the cryptos creak, the monsters creak. Spooks are coming out for a swinging motherfucking wake. Muppets Haunted Mansion. This is the very first Muppet Halloween special that has ever been made, and the topic is Disney's Haunted Mansion, the ride that first opened in Disneyland has now been exported to several other places on the globe. The plot of Muppet's Haunted Mansion, it's just the fucking ride, but the great Gonzo, world famous daredevil artiste, has done it all, seen it all, and survived it all. But on Halloween night, the fearless Gonzo takes on the greatest challenge of his life by spending one very daring night in the most grim grinning place on earth, the Haunted Mansion.
I'm just here for the sound effects.
Okay, so to ask my very serious question about this, because like obviously I was immediately bought in, being both a massive fan of the Haunted Mansion and the Muppets. So I feel like this was tailor-made for me. But while watching it, I realized that for people who are not very intense fans of the Haunted Mansion, it might seem like utter gibberish. So, Amon, did you understand any of this is my first question.
I understood everything. So I think on a basic level everything works, but like as you say, I am nowhere near your level of fandom when it comes to the Haunted Mansion. And while, you know, who doesn't enjoy the Muppets, I'm not like, you know, one of those guys who's watched every Muppets thing ever. I came into on that level. As I say, on a basic level, I think it works. There's some light comedy to be found all the way through. All the Muppets, you know, have a really sort of fun presence about them, and definitely sort of, you know, feel sort of sufficiently Muppety from the Muppet stuff that I have watched. There's some really fun musical numbers there. There's a riff on Be Our Guest halfway through, which I enjoyed, and I even enjoyed the end credits song. That was fun. But yeah, like this is not a film that I will be thinking about much. It's just a nice, diverting 50-minute fun that I enjoyed, but again, forgettable mostly for me.
Shall I share how deep...
The look on Hannah's face when I said that word. I wish this was a visual podcast.
Okay, wait, Hannah, do you work? Because I feel like you have an interjection. So Do you want to go first and then?
It's more that I'm someone who has never really jived with Muppets, or, you know, I've watched some other things, but it's just been like a bit tedious, to be honest. And I watched this, I was like, wow, I love Pepe the Prawn. Like, he's my man now. I'm obsessed with him, and I've thought about him ever since. So when you said it's forgettable, I was like, I did not forget Pepe.
Understood.
So, yeah, and also, I mean, Clarice, remind me, though, because did we go to the Haunted Mansion together when we did D23? Because I feel like
we did.
I don't know if we went to the gift shop. But I've definitely done Haunted Mansion. I've been to Disneyland maybe like three times actually, because I think I did like you could go to Disney with Universal. Anyway, so I kind of did remember a lot of the little bits, but I'm not as versed as you are, Clarice. But there were things that I definitely did like enjoy seeing. And I like the fact that it was about Gonzo and Pepe, that it wasn't just another Kermit the Frog and Piggy kind of main narrative.
Well, this is the interesting thing about Gonzo and Pepe. I agree, Pepe is my second favourite Muppet. My first favourite Muppet being Rizzo, the rat.
Yeah.
the weird thing that about this is out. That, like, because, you know, it always used to be Gonzo and Rizzo, that they're always paired up, like, in, I think it's in Muppet's Christmas Carol, it's the two of them. In a lot of other, like, instances, they were always together. But what happened, from my understanding, is that the voice of Rizzo has left Disney Muppet Company on not great terms. And so Rizzo as a character, like, doesn't really appear in the Muppets anymore. And what they're doing here is basically trying to audition a replacement for Rizzo by having the character that I think personality-wise is closest to Rizzo, which is Pepe. And it kind of works. It's just a bit sad because I'm used to Rizzo and Gonzo. And it's a bit weird that it's now Pepe and Gonzo. Like, what happened? Like, within the Muppets universe, what happened? Did they have a falling out? Did something happen?
Wow, drama. There's a really funny bit. It's such a stupid, it's what I quite like about this whole thing. It's like the little kind of punny jokes that they do. But there's one where I think John Stamos turns up and like Pepe goes, Juan Stamos. And then, like, as in one, it's like John, but close enough. And I was like, that's just so funny to me. That's such a stupid joke, but I love it so much.
And you're just going around being like, where are the famous people?
Yeah. He was doing, yeah. And also, it made sense. The minute I found it was a prawn, I was like, oh, that's so funny. Like, the prawn. I love that. Because I love prawns as well. It's like my favorite, like, meat food.
I can't eat prawns, allergic.
Thank you for another bit of information about if I wanted to shake you out.
People, you heard it on this pod first. When I die, Hannah Flint is suspect number one. Get the cops to her house.
You forget, Vaughn. I'm editing this week, so you'll never hear it.
You mentioned there some famous people there. There are some cameos in this. Some of them are more memorable than others. Ed Asner, the legendary Ed Asner, who we lost recently, I would have liked him to have actually had some lines, given that this turned out to be one of his final performances, and we don't really get that, so that's a bit of a shame. Alfonso Ribeiro is here, Chrissy Metz is here, Danny Trejo shows up. So all of that is sort of, you know, it's pretty fun. I enjoyed it.
And John Stamos is the biggest Disney adult of them all. So it's quite funny because all the cameos are all people who are actually like huge Disney fans. So
yeah.
It's quite nice because you can tell that they were very happy to be there.
No, definitely. Also, what's her name who's in Community? She often hosts Disney stuff. She was in Endgame. What's her name, Yvonne?
Yvette Nicole Brown
as a chauffeur. Yeah. And she's obsessed with Disney. I did really enjoy that. And they had, what's her name, Skye Jackson as well, being one of the singing busts.
And, okay, so this is, I will give you two references to show how deep down the Haunted Mansion hole, I guess, this goes. So, when we meet
Madam... There's that word, hole, again.
I know. Madam, is it Pagoda? Madame Leota. She meant to be Madame Leota, the floating head. The woman, the maid, who comes to clean the ball at the end.
I knew it! I understood that reference!
So the woman is Kim Irvine, who is currently a Disney Imagineer and is the voice and face of Madame Leota during the Haunted Mansion holiday. But she is the daughter of Leota Toombs, who was also a Disney Imagineer and original face and voice of Leota.
I know this because I watched that Imagineer series on
She's on it, yeah.
And she's on it, they talk about it. And so that moment where she washes the Miss Piggy's like floating ball thing, that's a bit we're on about, right?
Yes, yeah. That's Kim Irvine, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that little nod.
And the second one is there's a bit where they reference the spiel that plays when your doom buggy, your ride vehicle, has to pause. Because either the ride, well, it's usually when either someone needs help getting out or getting in, or there's some reason they have to stop the ride. There's a little spiel that plays saying, like, we will be moving momentarily. And it's like, it's really recognizable if you're a Disney adult like I am and have been on the ride lots of times. And it's such a, to me, playing like the spiel of when the ride's broken is a real like deep dive for me. So I can tell that this special has been really made with a specific audience in mind. 100%. And so I was mainly just like, yeah, I'll be honest. I was mainly just watching it, getting very excited at like, I know what that is. Oh my God.
I wish I watched this with you. It would have just made it so much more. I would have been looking at you the half the time, but it would have been amazing.
I was just pointing at, I was doing the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing finger. Oh my God, it's the dueling fighters. And I love that they had Constance Hathaway by Taraji P. Henson's character.
Yes. I thought she was a lot of fun.
She was great. I didn't know she could sing. She sounded amazing.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed Will Arnett as the ghost host.
The ghost host.
Yeah. He had a number of fun moments.
Also, a very fitting role for him, considering his past roles. Spoilers, I won't give it away, but yeah. And also, I didn't recognize it was Darren Criss. I was like, look at this guy. Why do I know this guy? Darren Criss was the caretaker as well. So it's kind of fun. I think there was a nice marriage of like recognizable names, you know, nods to the Haunted Mansion, obviously, like abundance of those. But also like, I think maybe because it's 50 minutes and it was self-contained and it was so simple, wasn't it? Because in a way, it's like Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's like, you got to survive the night.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got like that, but like obviously less.
It's like literally the plot of the ride as well, because like they go to Madame Leota, then they go to the ballroom, then they meet Constance Hathaway. And in the ride, you also explode out of the window and go into the graveyard. So it's like beat for beat.
Yeah. And it's also very self-referential. There were certain, like, I liked how certain things that they said, it was very specific about the ride, about this is, it was kind of like nodded to these things. And it also, I don't know, I just thought it was like, I liked how it kind of played on like real adult issues. Like there's a bit where she's like, okay, we're going to take five. It's like, well, we got a break. What are we going to, well, we got unions. So union break. And it's like all these things that are kind of things that play out in the theme park as well, because they're obviously union performers, so it's kind of like all those little touches, I think, just made it really well-built world. And a kind of, compared this to Jungle Cruise, this is probably, the best way you can celebrate the rides is do it in this kind of playful way that's like low stakes, I think. Mm-hmm. Low stakes, and I like that.
Yeah, and I think the Muppets and the Haunted Mansion, like, the humor really gels together, because the Haunted Mansion has always been kind of self-referential and quite dry. I mean, the only thing that's missing is, like, the actual ride's quite dark. And they have taken out the Hanging Man, which would be understandable. Don't want that in the Muppets special. I'm kind of surprised it's still in the actual ride. But other than that, it's like, what really surprised me is like, oh, it's quintessentially Muppets and it's also quintessentially Haunted Mansion. And those things go very well together in a way that, I don't know if you could do a Muppet special of like, they go to the Jungle Cruise or they go to Pirates of the Caribbean. I don't know if it would work quite as well, because Haunted Mansion is also all about the puns.
Also, they've already done like Muppets Treasure Island, so it feels like you couldn't pick that thing again, really. Anyway,
have either of you watched the Eddie Murphy Haunted Mansion movie?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. That tells me all I need to know. Thank you.
Do not speak of the Haunted Mansion movie.
If you want a good Eddie Murphy Halloween movie, you've got to watch Vampire in Brooklyn. That is great.
Yeah,
I love that film. That also really scared me as well. I still think about like the moment where Eddie Murphy has like these like yellow eyes, and it's like, that's really menacing, and it really scared me, and I still got that imprinted in my brain when I think of scary vampires. I segue. You saw, though, Clarice, you also saw another kind of mysterious and ooky.
Yeah. Very much ooky spooky. So I watched Addams Family 2. I had also seen Addams Family 1. And look... Obviously, I'm a very big fan of the Addams Family. Probably doesn't need any explaining to anybody of, you know, the original cartoons, the TV show, even the 90s movies I really like. So I feel like I was coming into this franchise very, like, you know when ready. You want... Yeah, like, and you kind of want to have ownership over the thing and say, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. But I will say I tolerate the Addams Family movies.
And there's your poster quote, people.
Yeah, because, you know, there are lots of... They do that very annoying thing that animated family movies do, where they try to cram in modern references. So there's this, like, line where Gomez says, tell that Billie Eilish that she's a little too sunny for my taste. And it's like, it's already 2 months out of date, because she just changed her entire image and now she's, you know, got the blonde bombshell look. But what it does preserve is I like the design of the characters, because it's based off the original Charles Addams illustrations and they look weird. So the characters look weird. Take number one. And take number two, like, they keep all the morbid humor intact. There's a scene where Wednesday Addams builds a little sand guillotine for her brother Pugsley on the Miami beach. Found that very funny. Might just be me. And three, it still preserves the core idea of, like, what Charles Addams was trying to do, was using these gothic characters to highlight, like, the hypocrisy and absurdity of American suburbia. And so there's a great scene in the sequel where they go to, like, a child pageant thing and they put Wednesday in the, like, the tutu and the blonde curls. And obviously she's horrified. So it gets the basic things right. And so I feel like if... you are an Addams Family fan and you are with a child that wants to see it, don't worry too much. You may only be a small amount of upset.
I will say, I really enjoyed the first one. I haven't checked out the second one yet, but I really enjoyed the first one. So if it's anything like that, then hopefully I can dig it.
It's like not quite as good, but not worse.
Awful. Okay.
If that makes sense.
Just throwing out the poster quotes again, Clarice. Just amazing.
Like, it's... So, look, there's only one correct answer to this, so are you ready? Muppets Haunted Mansion. Are we streaming it, or are we joining the 999 Herbie Haunts waiting for your arrival? By skipping it, and then I kill you with my Constance Hatchaway axe. I'm on.
Because I like being alive, I'm going to say stream. Also because I did enjoy this.
Correct answer. Hannah?
I'm streaming. I'm streaming. Non-stop. Non-stop all week. Just going to have the background for everything.
Very good, very good. And then
and swiftly write some soft porn about Pepe the Frog.
Pepe! I'm so glad you love Pepe. I'm such a huge Pepe fan, and I feel like he's not as popular.
He's great. I love him so much.
Another thing that you can stream on Disney Plus right now is all 9 episodes of What If, which concluded its season this week with a lot of very cool action, I thought, because the Guardians of the Multiverse... teamed up to stop a rampaging Ultron Vision hybrid. And it was pretty cool for the most part. Again, rushed a little bit, as I think all episodes of the season have been to varying extents. But yeah, the action has sort of slowly escalated as the season has continued and just gotten more cosmic, which has led to, I think, incredible visuals. There's a big fight between Uatu and Ultron in the penultimate episode, which just looked absolutely stunning. And there's a number of really cool visuals in this finale episode as well. Hannah, you've been very sort of mixed on this season as a whole. What did you make of the finale?
Before we say that, I'm intrigued by this idea that you think it's rushed, because they're 30-minute episodes. Mm-hmm. And like, I have been enjoying the Avengers Assemble Secret War because I'm going through all the animated, and they're like 25 minutes. So I just, do you think that your expectations to have longer episodes are informed by the live action stuff? Whereas you can actually, because to me, I just think that that's never been an issue for me in these films at all. Sorry, not films, series.
Yeah. It's not necessarily that the episodes being 30 minutes long are the problem. It's that I think certain episodes are trying to do too much within that runtime. So, and when they do that, a number of the emotions that they want to elicit, you can't do. They don't land. Like, I think of the Zombies episode especially, they're trying to do so much within that episode that I don't know whether to cry or whether to laugh at heroes that we have come to know and love dying in droves. And with that episode in particular, it's 26 minutes long before you sort of, you know, include the credits. And we're 8 minutes into that episode, and all they've done at that point is sort of explain how this world has come to be and give us this like fun Spider-Man skit, like, you know, how to survive a zombie apocalypse. We haven't, at that point in the episode, gotten into the breadth and gotten into what the actual episode is going to be, and there's only like 14 minutes or so left. That's the sort of thing where if you're trying to do too much, then it ends up feeling rushed. And I think the best episodes in this series, in this season, have been where it's committed to a tone, it's committed to a story that they've been able to manage across that limited runtime which they've given themselves. So for me, the best episode of the season by far is, you know, the fridging notwithstanding, is that whole episode focused on Doctor Strange and how he sort of, you know, broke his world. It really committed to a tone. It told a story, I thought, very effectively, and it had a really big impact on me. But yeah, I think overall, the thing which I'll say overall about this season, as I say, is that the action, I think, has been really, really good, and has gotten like more, but bigger and better as the series has escalated and as all these characters have come together in typical patented MCU storytelling fashion at the end, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I just want to have fun. I think that's put a lot of expectations on an animated series that's just basically supposed to be like a quick segue, a quick like vignette of what could have been. Personally, that's what I think. So I don't know if I have that expectations of these episodes. But the final finale, yeah, it was good. Nice meet, team up. Kind of just made me realize, like, why have for so long they allowed men to dominate this franchise, if anything. But yeah, no, it was like fine. They're just easy viewing, watching things. I'm just not really that invested in it really. Because I just think the whole kind of, the idea that this is the whole web narratives of it again, I just think it's just a bit boring and a bit jarring, and it didn't actually, ultimately, you know, the fact is we're still dealing, by the end of it, we're still dealing with a character who's got Infinity Stones and we need to stop them destroying the universe. Like, this, I've seen this already. I feel like that, for me, just felt like kind of repetitive. So yeah, it was nice to see, like, you know, Captain Carter and Natasha in action, and, you know, I really enjoyed that they killed Hawkeye, so... That's about it.
Well, I think a whole lot more MCU fans are going to be invested in that series when it rolls around, I believe, in December. So Merry Christmas to us. But enough Marvel chat. It is time for our
hot take.
I'm a ghost snow.
Fantastic Beasts. How do you solve a problem like Fantastic Beasts? Because my word, has this franchise got problems. It's got a J.K. Rowling problem because she has said a number of controversial comments, shall we say, in recent months. It's got an Ezra Miller problem, even though everybody, it seems, has tried to forget the video footage we saw of him putting his hands on a woman. It's got a Johnny Depp problem, which has been very, very well documented. And it's just got a bad storytelling problem as well, because lest we forget...
It's just not good.
lest we forget, sorry, the second film in this franchise was not good. I should not be feeling this apathetic about a film which stars the great Mads Mikkelsen, but here we are. Hannah, I'm going to come to you first here. Should there be any excitement for more films in this franchise? Why are we still pressing ahead with a third one? Explain.
Because they've already spent money on it. Because
good explanation.
Because studios don't care. Because social media is a bubble, not representative of the rest of the world. So any kind of criticisms that we have about it, that's within our vacuum. It doesn't really matter. And, you know, people watch things and they don't, you know, they're not engaged in this conversation. So personally, like, am I interested in it? Like, no. Because I don't think the previous two have been that great, to be honest. Just even if you take away all of the drama around it, I still find that the kind of plotting is a bit not really that interesting. I'm a bit bored of the kind of continuation of a world in a way that actually is just a kind of, I suppose, a way for J.K. Rowling to somewhat retcon her completely whitewashed, very cisgendered, very heterosexual world, like, and then trying to like suddenly make it better. And to be honest, it's kind of, she's just making it more problematic in nature by doing all that with the, you know, pre-kid with the characterization of Nagini. You know, that's one of the big issues that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I understand exactly why they're making it, and I think enough people will go see it because there's a lot of Harry Potter fans. Do I think they should have made it or continued it? No. Do I think they should have hired Johnny Depp to do it in the first place when there was obviously clear evidence about his involvement in domestic violence? No. It'll hopefully lead to more people making, instead of doing corrections, they'll like find the preventative actions rather than trying to find a solution for all these dramas. Do you know what I mean? It always comes afterwards. Mm-hmm.
The fan base is really divided right now. Clarice, do you think this third film, and I think they want to do more with this franchise as well, do you think they can be sort of, you know, good enough, I guess, to bring the fan base back together and just really sort of after the disappointment of the second film, and given that we're still sort of, you know, as a culture, you know, coming back from COVID, do you think that the box office is still going to be there for this film when the film comes out?
I don't know. It's interesting you say fan base divided, because I think if we're talking about like the hardcore, like the Harry Potter fans, I have almost universally seen like all the Harry Potter accounts, like the people who do like the cosplays and, you know, the people who are really involved in Harry Potter, like essentially just disown J.K. Rowling. They've just gone like, we love this thing and we love what it's given to us and we're going to keep making our own art, you know, based around Harry Potter. But like this person, we don't want it anymore. But the thing is, like, that hardcore fan base are not going to be the deciding factor in whether the new Fantastic Beasts money, bleh, they're not going to be the deciding factor in whether this new Fantastic Beasts movie makes money, right? Because that's just going to be like,
well, absolutely,
average-ass people, yeah.
People are going to see Marvel movies, most of them have never read a Marvel comic, do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you've got to remember, like, these things, I mean, if anything, it showed you even, like, with, what's it called? The Justice League, the one that Zack Snyder did on HBO. Mm-hmm. And they revealed the actual, like, who was watching it. No one was watching it because no one gave a shit about it except for these. It was literally made for a specific fan. So, like, it didn't do as well as, like, Wonder Woman Night, all these things. So yeah, kind of the whole point of that, these big franchises is to make them universally beloved. You know, make it that you don't have to have read the source material if you want to actually be invested in these characters.
Yeah, and so I think, like, a lot of people who are going to end up going to see this new Fantastic Beasts movie probably don't know any information about the situation, because, like, the stuff around Johnny Depp, like, you know, they'll have noticed it's a different actor, but they may not really know what happened. I know certainly lots of people outside of the UK have no idea what's happening with J.K. Rowling, because that is, you know, Turf Island. that's a this country situation.
Yeah. But it's also, like I said, a social media thing. Like, these things happen online. Like, not every single person in the world is on Twitter. Yeah. So these conversations are happening and people are, like, ignorant to all that. And it's not that they're ignorant, it's just that, I mean, to be honest, blissfully in a way unaware, because some of the absolute bullshit that's been spouted, especially on the Turf side, is just like, I'd hate the idea that people would see all this and suddenly that would inform their opinion because it's awful.
Yeah, and so, like, I think, like, my personal relationship to these movies is that, you know, I don't hold any resentment about Warner Brothers doing this, because they're locked into contracts. Like, this is a franchise that they own and they don't really know what to do with now. Like, I sort of feel a little bit sorry for them, because, like, they've just been handed the worst deal, the most cursed production that you could ever imagine.
Yeah, I don't feel sorry for them, because after the kind of decision to cast Johnny Depp after all this stuff came out, like, they wrote that letter along with J.K. Rowling, did that whole piece defending it. So, I do not have any sympathy in that way for that studio.
That's true. No, you're right about the doubt. I guess I was thinking more about the nature of Harry Potter, like them having Harry Potter.
No, I get it. I think in a way it's like, I get what you're trying to say, but I find it there's a struggle, because, to be honest, I always find with these studios, same with, like, what happened with Gina Carano, like, it got to the point where she was still in this show. And don't get me wrong, I don't want to get into all that type of thing. But it took them a while for them to get to the point where, like, they wanted to keep her on it until she got to a point where she was just pushing it too far. So they had to do it. But if they could have, I don't know, there can be stuff that they could have done beforehand.
Yeah. It's very true. Yeah. I guess it's more of the J.K. Rowling thing. It's like, what do they even do with Harry Potter now?
I live in Watford. There's still the whole Harry Potter thing in Watford is still booming. You know, people are still going out. They're still releasing video games and other content to do with Harry Potter. And so the machine is still going, and a big part of the money that comes from that machine is still going to J.K. Rowling.
Yeah. And it's like, you can't really just boot her out of it because she created it. So I don't.
I mean, I will say, like, there's the Mads Mikkelsen of it all. That, again, obviously, he's one of the best actors we have right now. A big reason why the second one for me really didn't work was that J.K. Rowling was on script duties. And, you know, you could see the screenplay working much better in a book than a film. With this one, Steve Kloves is joining her on the script. So maybe that will make a difference. But yeah,
I still can't believe she made this backstory of Lita Lestrange. Is that it? The Zoe Kravitz character, that basically she's a product of rape using the Imperius curse, and no one kind of talks about it.
There's a lot of problems with that movie.
I remember at the time, I remember pitching to a lot of people wanting to write about that. And, like, no one took it. And it really annoyed me, because I felt like, and especially after Wonder Woman 1984 and the Bridgerton conversation, it's like, how are you using it? Because also that's a black woman who is being raped by a white man under the Imperius curse. And we're just throwing that in just casually. Like, that's not a really awful thing to happen. I don't know. I thought that was really weird to have that use that as a plot device in a Harry Potter film. You know, a child. Like, I get these dark things, but that's a really fucking dark thing.
Yeah, and followed up with that whole thing that was like, why didn't wizards stop the Holocaust? It's just a bit like, It's a fucking fantasy movie. Yeah, can we about just have it a little separate? Boy with a wand. Like, why are you involving like one of the most traumatic things ever? Just ever.
Anyway, the Not-So-Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore will be released in April 2022. The press tour for that one should be interesting. But on that note,
There is not going to be a press tour for that movie. It's going to be a premiere that no one is allowed, no one is invited, and then it will be snuck onto HBO Max. And
I will say, I really like Callum Turner, who's an actor in it. And I like his Theseus character.
I really like Catherine Waterston.
Yeah. So, like, it's not all bad. And, you know, it's disappointing because I think Mads Mikkelsen should have been cast as...
Grindelwald.
Grindelwald. Is it Grindelwald? I think he should have been cast in the first place. It's maddening to me that he wasn't. It makes no sense. But, you know, I'm here for Mads getting all that franchise money.
Seeing as we're all saying one nice thing about Fantastic Beasts, I have one nice thing about the second film. The waistcoats were fire. And the jackets were also fire. And that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing. It's like this situation. I think what I was trying to say before is like I'm not even angry about the situation. I'm just very like sad about it. It's just really sad, like this whole thing. Because it should just be a fun movie about wizards. But it's got
so much baggage now.
Yeah, it's been co-opted into a hate movement. It's like become attached to this really horrific, case of abuse. It's like all this stuff, and it makes me sad for all the people who are like good-hearted and just want to make this movie and are not, you know, not connected to that. And it's like, God, what do you do now?
That is it for episode 32 of the Fate of Black podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And happy viewing via whatever medium is the safest for you. Do subscribe, rate, and leave us a review if you love the podcast. It really does make a difference. And tweet us if you have something you'd love us to shout out next week. And get down to LFF to check out some films. Use the hashtag BetaBlackPod and follow us. I am at Amon Warman on Instagram and Twitter.
I'm at Hannah Flint on Twitter and at Hannah Ines Flint on Instagram.
And I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter and at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
Oh, look at those seagulls. The seagulls are not on social media. They're in Brighton on the beach.
Oh, I bet they fucking are on social media. I bet there's like a seagull Twitter parody account. Squawk, squawk, getting some fish and chips, squawk.
And on that glorious note, farewell, film friends. It is time to fade to black.
Hurry back, be sure to bring your death certificate if you decide to join us.